academics take themselves very seriously. It's like they're the priests of knowledge, and they're doing really important stuff, although tomorrow nobody will agree with them. I mean, none of these ideas last. We're just doing the best we can. You know, I tell people, I said, look, 200 years ago, we didn't even have toilet paper. We're not a really smart creature. You know, we're just apes. And the idea that we're going to find the truth of the universe, you know, we're just basically hairless gorillas. You know, we set these absurd goals and take ourselves so seriously.
Imagine you're living in a world that has no concept of beauty or guilt. You only work 4 hours a day, and most of the time you're laughing loud, and you and your family is considered the happiest people. This is the world of the Pidaha. Daniel Everett lived with the indigenous Pidaha in the Brazilian Amazonian basin for almost 8 years and studied them since 1977. Originally, he went to this tribe as a missionary to translate the Bible into their language. But instead of turning the Pidaha into Christians, their way of living and just believing what they see or who they know changed his life completely. He turned to atheism, got divorced from his former wife, and went on to be a famous linguist. This podcast brings you stories from and about people who stepped into the unknown. Stories about fear, uncertainty, the illusion of security, or I don't know. Let's see what it will be about. My name is Katarina Bayer, and I will host you on this journey into the unknown. So in your book, Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, Life and Language in the Amazonian Jungle, you write, among the Pidaha, there is no sign of depression, chronic fatigue, extreme anxiety, panic attacks, or other psychological disorders that are so common in our industrialized countries. The Pidaha are exposed to constant danger. Their life expectancy is far shorter than ours. And I read in your book that they only sleep a few hours a day. How do they manage to be far healthier than we are?
Their health is dependent on their psychology, their diet, their exercise. And they feel very much at home in their environment. And they don't fear their environments. They know that they are capable of handling anything in their environment. The Pidaha are active almost all day, every day. They're either hunting or fishing or gathering food from the jungle, or they're laughing and playing in the village. And sleep is not a priority. They watch a lot of animals. And Pidaha took me to the jungle one time and showed me a big termite hill at night. And he said, see how they're working all night long and they work all day long? He said, that's how we want to be. So it is a value for the majority of the village to always be awake. And people take naps at different times. But it's this social context and connection between everyone, their mastery of their environment, their lack of fear, these things lead them to a very healthy lifestyle.
When you started your way with the Pidaha, you started as a missionary, and now you're an atheist. Can you say due to which reasons you're changed your belief and which view on religion in total you have right now?
Yes, I went to the Pidahas as an evangelical fundamentalist Christian. I believe the Bible literally, and I raised my children to believe the Bible literally. So when I got to the Pidaha, I was the epitome of the American evangelical Christian. And when I started with them, and they would show little interest in what I had to say, I thought, well, I'm not expressing it well. And that was certainly partially true because I was learning the language. But one day a Pinaha man came in, and there were several other men with him sitting around, and he said, Dan, we really like you, and we know that you're trying to tell us about Jesus, but we really don't want to hear about Jesus. We're not interested in Jesus. We're not Americans. You know, we do what we do, and you do what we do, and you do what you do. So I then realized that they would ask me questions. They would say, you know, when you saw Jesus, did he look like us or did he look like you in skin color? And I said, well, I never saw Jesus. There are some people who say he looks brown, and other people who say he was white. And they said, oh, you never saw him. Did your father see him? And I said, no, my father never saw him. And who saw them? Who saw him that you know? And I said, no one has ever seen him. No one alive has ever seen him. And they said, you know, why are you telling us about him then? I mean, this just didn't make any sense to them that you would talk about something that you had no contact with, that you had never seen directly. And so the other thing that caused me to really rethink, I mean, first of all, they made it clear that he was not fulfilling any kind of need in their lives. I thought that they would be waiting for the message of salvation and so happy to get it. But they said, you know, it's irrelevant. It's fine for you to do that. But then there was also the fact that they were always asking me questions like that one about where I got the source of my evidence. And I really didn't have good answers. They have a lot of... I mean, they even have verb suffixes that tell you whether you got this from hearsay or you directly observed it or you inferred it. So evidence is very important to them. And I realized I didn't have the evidence. So not only did I not have the evidence I felt that they required for beliefs, but the point of Christianity, aside from saving people from hell, you know, many Christians think that's the main reason, but I never really, I mean, that's fine. I believed in hell at the time, but my main reason for going was to give them the opportunity to have a better life, to feel at peace with the environment, to feel certain about their future. And then I realized none of this is necessary because it's superfluous. They already feel at home in their environment. They're already extremely happy, more so than most missionaries, and certainly more so than most Christians I had ever known. As I stopped to think about it, I realized if Christians are the evidence for the gospel, the evidence is not very strong because there simply isn't enough change and difference in the Christian population from the regular population. They're not. And I began to realize that for me, they're no more moral than anybody else, and they're no more happy, sometimes much less happy. So I began to question my faith and say, you know, this really, I don't have the evidence for it. It doesn't produce the results that I had thought that it produced. You know, really, what am I doing believing this stuff? I mean, they seem a lot happier than me, and they're a lot less burdened by guilt. So I'm now an atheist. I gave up my faith entirely, and I wasn't a Christian before. You know, I was not raised in a Christian family. I was raised by, an alcoholic father, and my mother died young, and nobody went to church, and no, people thought that was silly. And then when I was a teenager, that's when I became a Christian and was converted by a missionary family who worked in the Amazon. So that's why I wanted to go there. So I was a Christian probably for 20 years, maybe 25. But my doubts started coming very early on with my work with the Pinaha.
What is interesting to me is I mean, you write in your book that they usually don't speak about the past, regrets, or the future. And also, religion is something imaginary. And when I think about modern things like social media, yoga, or spirituality, this is also imaginary. Why do you think that we Western people live so much in this imaginary world and they don't do?
Well, first of all, they don't have access to all the electronics we have access to, or the and they don't tell fictional stories of the past or fictional stories of the future. They live in the present. They have what I've called an immediacy of experience principle, which is very strong in their culture. But they don't fear things. Death is a natural thing. There's just no reason for them to believe in all these myths and things. Brazilians, as well as American missionaries, tell them all sorts of stories that they find incredulous. I mean, and that they're incredulous, they find unbelievable, these stories. So they find us very strange that we're superstitious. I mean, this Amazonian hunter-gatherer group finds American missionaries to be very superstitious, as well as Brazilian Christians. So they don't really see any need in their own lives for these beliefs. You know, celebrity guilt. To me, the greatest, most positive component of Pitahā society is the absence of guilt. They change names frequently, and this works to their advantage because if I get back to the village tomorrow, many people will be using different names. And if I call them by the name they had when I was there, they'll say, "You talking to me? That's not my name." Then somebody else will say, "That was his name long ago, but it's a used name. He threw it away. He's got another name now." And very often they refuse to take responsibility for anything that was done under that old name. You know, so
they invent themselves new.
Yeah, they reinvent themselves on a regular basis. So there are two reasons why they don't, or several reasons why they don't feel guilt, as far as I can tell. First of all, the concept doesn't make much sense. There's no utility in it for them. Guilt has come to us largely through religion and the feeling that we're somehow bad people. They don't think they're bad people. They don't think of people as good or bad, you know? I mean, they can characterize somebody as having a bad head when they do mean things, but they don't say that one group of people is better than another, or that, you know, everything I do in the course of my life is just what I did. Some of it may not be very good, and society will let me know that. Other things nobody will know but me, and why should I feel guilty about those things? And that's a Pitahā philosophy, and it's very difficult for those of us who come from religious cultures, even when we were raised atheists, it's very difficult for us to get away from guilt. So, first of all, it's a foreign concept. Second, they change names, and they start new periods in their life. And third, they simply do not talk about the distant past or the distant future. And, you know, sometimes a guy will come back from the field and tell me that he's really missing a friend who died. So they do know about the past. He will ask me, "You remember when this happened?" But they don't normally talk about those sorts of things. Most of their discourse is about the present and the things that are happening right now. I don't think that's very different from us. We have historians. They don't have historians. They don't see a need for history in that sense. So it's a very healthy environment. It's a very healthy society. And, they very much enjoy their bodies. They like all the things that have to do with the flesh. They enjoy those things. They like to eat. They eat all they can when they have food. They're never going to gain weight because they never, you know, they're always exercising and they don't always have food. Very healthy sexual lives, which they talk about frequently and openly. I mean, This is just not a matter of, but they have some modesty, but not a great deal, not compared to us, and certainly no guilt about this. This is not to say that they're perfect people, and there's some things that they do, you know, maybe stealing something from me that I wish they did feel guilty about. But they steal it from me because they think I have plenty and I'm not going to miss it. And actually, they're right. You know, if they steal something from me while I'm out in the village, it will never be anything of significant value. I mean, they would never steal, for example, my tape recorder. They might take a package of cookies that I left at the side to have with my coffee later. That they might take, but I can live without that, you know. I mean, and so they only take things like that. So they have this incredibly healthy psychological life, which is very appealing to me. And when I'm with them, somebody visited me in the village from my university when I was at Pittsburgh. And they said, "You're a totally different person here. You seem so relaxed. And at Pittsburgh, you always seem tense and angry or something." And I said, "Well, this is just extremely relaxing place. I can't get angry here. There's nothing to get angry about. There's no competition. There's no compunction to do certain things except do your job while you're there."
I understand that the Pidaha had an amazing influence on you. Is there anything except like changing your religion that you see in daily life that you totally changed after coming back living with them?
Yeah, many things. And my children, too. We get around when we're together. We talk very often in Pidaha and certainly a lot in Portuguese about changes. One small thing is I used to be afraid of bees and spiders and things like that. And I don't even pay attention to those things anymore. I'm totally not worried about it. You know, I'll be talking to somebody and some big bee will come buzzing around us and they get really scared. And I'm thinking, I don't even understand what they're scared of, you know, because I've gotten used to it. And I also, when I go for walks in the woods, even though we have almost no poisonous snakes in Massachusetts, I'm always watching the ground because I've had so many experiences with snakes. In terms of my values, I don't know if I've ever feared death, but I certainly don't fear it. You know, one of the nice things about getting older is that you just don't fear these things as much anymore. But also, it's the perspective of the Pidaha, the idea that this is just a natural part of life. And, you know, you can look at your children or your family and realize that I'm not going to be around forever. But, you know, it really doesn't matter. You just enjoy what you have right now. And, you know, academics talk about the importance of their work for posterity. Who's going to read my work in 100 years? And to me, the answer to that is, who cares? I enjoy writing this stuff, and I enjoy, you know, getting invited to speak places and all this. But what difference does it make to me whether anybody ever reads this stuff when I'm dead? I mean, I'd like to think sometimes that it will help somebody. Sometimes frequently I get emails from people in different parts of the world telling me how valuable Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes was for them. And that's great, but, you know, I'm not going to be around forever, and so they're not going to have anybody to write, and I'm not going to care about it. I won't be here to care about it. So I just enjoy my life right now, and I do the things that I do because they give me great satisfaction and great pleasure, and I do believe that I've learned these things from the Pidaha.
You know, you say that people write to you because it influenced them what you wrote, and I can say it for myself that also whenever I open your book, I reflect on myself, why I stress myself with things that are not really important. So your research actually gives something to us, but what does it give to them?
That's a very good question, and I ask myself that sometimes, you know. When I went to the Pidaha, malaria was something that was killing lots of people. And I took in a lot of anti-malarial medicine and I worked very hard. My wife and daughter almost died of malaria. I had malaria at least 5 times. One time I almost died from it. And but I was able to contribute dramatically to their health. And also antibiotics and snake venom, anti-venom. You know, I treated snake bites. I treated infections. I treated people who shoved arrows all the way through their arms and got terribly infected. We've sewn up people who, you know, split their foot open with an axe and that kind of thing. So those are all short-term kinds of contributions. But to those people, they can think back. I visited 10 years ago, I visited a Brazilian community on the river near the Pirajá that I hadn't visited for 20 years before that. One of the men, you know, they all called me by name. Everybody knows me. And one of the men called me, says, come with me, Daniel, I want to show you something. So we walked into a room and there was this really nice, good-looking 18-year-old boy lying in a hammock. And he said, my boy was dying and you saved his life. Do you remember that? And I didn't. He came up. I mean, he talked to me about it, and eventually his boy came up, and we were able to help him and give him medicine. And he said, every day of my boy's life, I am happy. I'm thankful for you. So these are the kinds of contributions that I have made, and there's nothing deeply philosophical about it. I haven't changed their worldview, you know.
They have just changed yours.
Yes, they changed my worldview totally, and well, almost totally, in many profound ways.
So you were 26 when you first went to them. You already had 3 children and a wife, and you went to a jungle, to a place that you don't know, in a language that you didn't know. If I think about myself with 26, I would never have done any of them. So can you remember and recall how it felt for you back then when you entered this jungle for the first time and heard this language?
Yes, the first time I went into the Pirajá was without my family, and this was December of 1977, and the plane landed, and we had a little jungle missionary plane, and it landed, and I was airsick, and I was almost about to throw up. And I got out of the plane. It was really hot and humid, and I was surrounded by all these people talking in a language I had no idea what it was. But I just started working using the methods that I knew and putting phrases together. And I was very good mimic, like a parrot. And I could say things back to them, even if I didn't understand them. And this impressed them. So I spent some time there getting to know them. The first visit, less than 2 weeks, only about 10 days. Then I came back in the next year because all kinds of things were going on in the Brazilian government that delayed my return. And when I got back the next year, I worked with another fellow for about 10 days again to get it ready for my family. And then the plane brought in my family and flew out with this buddy of mine. And I was so excited to show them this place for the first time. And we had jungle training as a family. So my children were really used, they spoke Portuguese, they were really used to roughing it, and but there was nothing like it. They suddenly had no friends, they had nobody to talk to. The Pirajá children were just touching them all the time and feeling their clothes and feeling them, and you know, very often because women and men in our societies dress a lot alike, you know, for the Pirajá. It's common for women and men to wear pants and t-shirts and all this sort of thing. So the Pirajá might walk up to somebody like my daughter and feel her top to see if she's male or female. You know, this is not sexual harassment. This is just information. They're just trying to get information. And so these things really, I had 2 daughters and 1 little boy son. And so these things took a lot of adjustments, but they did extremely well. And within no time, my daughters had friends and were speaking the language far better than I did. I would say that those were some of the best memories we have as a family. And I've talked to my kids about it. And my middle daughter, who's a doctor of nursing and also, a business executive and really successful, she said her favorite memories are lying in the hammock in the village at night with me reading to them by kerosene lamp, reading books like To Kill a Mockingbird or The Chronicles of Narnia, and literature that I thought they should know about. Sometimes even poetry. I read a lot of poetry to my children, and they think these are some of the best memories they had. And so they say, well, we wouldn't take our own children there. We would never do that. But we're glad we went. We're glad we had the experience. They could have died. As a Christian, I believe that we were all immortal until our task was done. And if my children died, that's what God had in mind. That was God's business. I don't have that view now. And I would never take them.
So with all the information you have now, and also with knowing that sometimes we as Westerners bring diseases to Indigenous people, if you had the chance again, would you go there again if you were 26 now?
Oh, yeah, I would. I might be different with respect to my family. I probably would talk to my children more and give them more of a choice. But, you know, the Brazilian government required that we have an entire list of vaccinations and that we see a doctor before we could go out there. So the Brazilian government wouldn't let us out there. The Pitahas fear colds. You know, coronavirus would be terrible for them. The flus and colds they fear. So if you get to the Pitahã and you cough or sneeze, they don't like that. They say, why are you sneezing? Do you have a cold? And if you do, they're going to be very upset that you came out there because they have no resistance. Colds will kill them. Just a common cold can kill a Pitahã. So they have no resistance to these things. And they don't want people out there who are sick. So not only does the Brazilian government require that you show that you're free of certain diseases, after a certain period of time, I had to get a certificate that showed that I didn't have AIDS. They really, any new disease, yellow fever, all of these things. And the Pitahã also are inspecting you. They don't want somebody sick coming out to the village. So, so far as I know, no one ever got sick because of my family.
You already mentioned that they are happy, and in German, your book, I guess you know, is called The Happiest People. And what I read is that some psychologists from MIT's Brain and Cognitive Science Department did research on the Pitahã and found out that, I don't know, they did it with the smile time or something, that they're really the happiest people they ever met. Why do you think they are? You mentioned something already, but has it really to do with not fearing death and just living in the present moment?
I think it has to do with those things, and it has to do with a lot of other things. So, for example, in 2007, I took down a team that included a PhD student from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who today is a full professor at Stanford University. And I took a professor from MIT. And I took two PhD students, one Dutch and one German from Europe. And so we were all there together, and everybody had their assigned tasks. And several of them were commenting on how much the Pitahã laugh and smile. And one of the people said, these seem like the happiest people in the world. And I said, "What? How would you tell that, really? How would you judge? How would you evaluate that?" And he said, "I would just measure the time they spend smiling and laughing and compare that to the time that Americans spend smiling and laughing or any other people." That's one way to test it. And it could be superficial, you know, but it isn't. I know them now well enough to know that they really are this happy. And why are they so happy? Well, again, it has to do with First of all, they live in a beautiful place. It's difficult to describe how wonderful the Amazon is. It's hot and it's humid and there's malaria and there's snakes. But really, on a day-to-day basis, it is a beautiful place. And weather is always great. If you like hot and humid weather and you don't like cold, the weather is always great. You don't have to worry about your clothes or anything like that. So life is good for them. They know how to get food. There's plenty of food. They know how to take care of their needs. You know, men love to fish. They have to fish to make a living. But just like every man I've ever known, except me, likes to fish, the Pinaha love to fish. And it's a great thing because you make your living doing what you love to do. And very few of us can say that. I can say that now. I couldn't say that then. And then there's no guilt. There's no worry about what happened in the past. There's no worry about the future. There's absolutely no fear of death. Nobody's trying to die. Nobody wants to die in the next 5 minutes. But they're not afraid of it. They're very wise and, you know, about this. And if you hear that a Pinaha has died, which they do, obviously, it won't be because of some silly, stupid mistake on their part. It will be because of disease. You watch the Pinaha children and how graceful they are and how, compared to our children, they're quiet. I took my two grandsons, both of whom are married now, to the village when they were little boys. And they were running around naked like everybody else. I have some great photos of them naked, which I want to show it. You know, I show their wives and stuff. But they were falling all the time, you know. They didn't cry. They were tough little boys, but they were clumsy compared to Pinaha kids. And Pinaha children take up less room. They're not just, when they run, it's in a very straight line. Their bodies are, the average Pinaha stands with their arms crossed to take up less room. Because in the jungle, if you run like we do with your arms all out, you'll get knocked over, maybe get bitten by a snake. So they always keep themselves close. So they know how to live. They know how to live in their environment. They're well adapted to their environment and they're conscious of themselves. They know, you know, there's a thing called proprioception, which is our sensitivity to our body and where our body is, you know. Is my hand, you know, where's my hand right now? Well, we tend to know these things, but we don't know them as well as the Pinaha do, which is why we're always bumping our heads and these sorts of things when we're out there. It's just it's a great example of cultural adaptation and evolution to fit a particular niche emotionally, socially, and physically.
You know, I think I remembered now that you wrote in your book or you said it in an interview that they even get like sharp knives or something to play with because then they get used to it. And now I remembered that my mom did the same. So I guess she already knew how to prepare me for life.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, most Western parents would be horrified if they saw their child walking around the kitchen waving a sharp, long knife. But not the Pinahas, and apparently not your mother. They also, if somebody starts to walk to the fire, a little child, they'll say, don't, it's hot. But they're not going to pull the child back from the fire. If the child gets burnt on the foot or the hand or something, they won't go near the fire again. It's the best lesson they can learn, is with real experience. And so this is a very important source of knowledge for the Pinaha, is personal experience, what you've done. They don't read about it. They're not told stories about it. They do it.
When you talk about them and what I know that they just work a few hours a day and rather sit together and talk and how you told about this amazing place that they're living, why don't you live there?
Oh, well, that's a good question, and it has to do with I grew up in the United States, and I was I'm an enculturated American. I like being with the Pinaha, but I don't have any of their skills. I can't fish. I can't hunt. I don't know. The only reason I can live with them and stay alive is because I have money from my society that enables me to buy food and to, you know, and I can build a simple shelter. You know, I build a house in the jungle. Nobody else would want to live in the house probably, but I built the house. And so I'm not as good at their environment as they are. And I do have professional aspirations in this country, writing and talking. But it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for me to be told that I was going to live with the Pitahas for the rest of my life. I just would know that I probably wouldn't live very long because I'm not very, I'm such a bad fisherman. And Pitaha women were always asking me if I wanted to have children, Pitaha children, and stay there. And I would say, I couldn't take care of my children. I don't know how to do anything. And they would think about it and they would say, yeah, that's right. You don't know how to do anything. So that answered their questions for them.
So you are very well known as a linguist, and the language of the Pitaha is quite different to ours because they don't have words for colors or no concept of counting, and they are far more like in the present with their language. Do you think that it makes life more real if you don't have all these concepts that we have or speak so much about things that could happen or happened?
Well, there are two, according to philosophers, there are two basic positions one can take about the world. One can be a realist or one can be a nominalist. And a realist, this sounds bizarre, but the thing that distinguishes a realist is that they believe that abstract objects are real. So if I say the color red, you believe in a concept red and you believe that concept is real. The Pitahas are nominalists. They don't believe in abstract things. They believe that what you see is what you get. So this I might call, this looks like blood, because they don't have a word for red. And this looks like blood, and this looks like blood. But there's no overarching concept. They're just descriptions. They don't have any concept of red. They can see three Brazil nuts and three fish, and they will say, you know, that's a couple of Brazil nuts and that's a couple of fish, but they don't think that they share this common property of threeness, that there's three. So in a sense, if you think about it, the Pitahas have a philosophical position that was largely the same position as, say, David Hume, one of the greatest philosophers in the English language. So it's not an ignorant position that they have, but they don't believe in abstractions. They believe in what they can sense and what they see in the here and now. And whether you think that's right or wrong philosophically, or whether you can even decide what's right or wrong philosophically, the overall effect, their philosophy, their relationship to life, leads them not to worry about abstract possibilities. It's not that they're stupid and they can't think abstractly. David Hume was brilliant. He could definitely think abstractly. He just didn't believe in the reality of abstract things. And nobody would call him stupid. So, I have people say, well, if the Pitaha don't believe in this, they must be stupid. Well, then David Hume is also stupid. And this doesn't make any sense. So, what I can say is that I worked with over 20 different Amazonian groups, including the Pitaha. None of them compare in happiness to the Pitaha. And so it's not just an Amazonian thing. This is a particular set of cultural values that have evolved over time from this people. And it is unique to these people among the groups I've ever worked with. I'm not saying that there couldn't be somebody else that has this. So yeah, I am developing a course on happiness that I plan to start teaching for business majors. What does it mean to be happy in life? And it's not money.
No, it sounds so interesting because when you already were talking about it, I was like, okay, do I need sharp knives? I only speak in the present and I need more humidity and then I am happier.
Yeah, it's an adaptation to all those things. You know, any city that I'm in, I feel happy. And one of the things about the Pitahas, I don't feel loyal to any place. I was born and raised in Southern California. I've lived a long time in Brazil. I lived in England. I lived a year in Germany. I've traveled a lot. I live in Massachusetts. I don't feel loyal to any of those places. If there were an opportunity to move somewhere else that I thought were professionally interesting or interesting for some other reason, I would. I don't feel roots. And the Pitahas' semi-nomadic life in a much smaller space, they're not traveling the whole world, but they're traveling up and down the Maasai, you know, they don't feel roots to any particular part of the Maasai as we feel, you know, very often. I've talked to people who've never been out of Boston. They just, you know, they were born and raised in Boston, and that's fine. I'm not saying that it's wrong to just like to be in one place and eat one kind of food, but I enjoy variety, and the Pinaha have directly and indirectly taught me a lot of the values that make me happy right now.
You just mentioned that you not just research the Pitahas, but other indigenous tribes as well. Where does your curiosity for those people come from?
It comes from a couple of sources. I grew up on the Mexican border, Southern California. You could see Mexico from my front door. We went to Mexico. That's where all the best restaurants were. Everybody I knew spoke Spanish. They also spoke English. But I noticed I didn't speak Spanish. I noticed this early on when we would be playing, say, American football, and my Mexican-American friends would be yelling at each other in Spanish, you know, mira, Jose, mira, you know, talking to each other. And I thought, I don't know what they're talking about. And I really want to know what they're talking about. So I would start spending more time with them. You know, I love the food, you know, which I didn't know it was Mexican food. It was just food, you know. I mean, now I know people call it Mexican food, but for us, it was just food. And I learned to speak Spanish. It's been affected by all my years speaking Portuguese, but I can understand Spanish perfectly and say pretty much what I need to say. That got me interested in languages and diversity and seeing different peoples. And so I find nothing brings me greater joy in the world than to encounter new people. I love nature. I love seeing beautiful mountains and oceans, but none of that excites me as much as new cultures, seeing new people and how people have learned to adapt and live in life. And when you walk into a different group, whether it's in Rome or whether it's in some isolated little Amazonian village, the people's culture is what I find most invigorating and most enjoyable to try to understand. So although I lived with the Pitahas for roughly 8 years, I also stayed for months by myself with the Banawa people, and I wrote a large book on the grammar of the Wadi people, and I've worked with many different groups and written articles on many different languages. And it's a great source of satisfaction to understand something new about people's lives through their cultures and languages.
I want to return back to one thing we already discussed a bit. You know, I'm 35 years now, and you can imagine that most of my friends have children or are pregnant. And what I read is that the Pitahas don't have like a child language in the meaning of a trivialized word, words, what we do. And as far as I understood, they also would not say it's a child. It's just a smaller human being. I mean, you were there with your three children, and it must have been a big impact on how they were raised. Do you think that we could learn something about how we should treat our children?
Definitely. One of my afflictions as a parent, who was an evangelical Christian, is that I believed in spanking my children. You know, get a stick and spank them. This was 100% of all evangelical Christians at that period of time, spanked their children. I can't think of anybody who didn't do that. It was considered being a good Christian parent. The Pitahas hated that, and I couldn't spank my children around them. You know, my oldest daughter says she remembers me telling her, meet me 100 yards out in the jungle and I'm going to give you a spanking, you know. And she would tell all her friends, my dad's going to hit me. And so they would all follow out there. And then I would never spank her, of course, because
they How were, smart.
Yeah, yeah, I was really smart. But so they taught me that that's a pretty stupid thing to do. They just didn't understand it at all, why you would hurt somebody weaker than yourself. You know, why would you do that? It's not to say that they're perfect. You know, people lose their temper and they hit people. You see that in the Pitaha. You see it everywhere else. It's not a good thing. But I remember, and I talk about this in the book, I was walking over to see, I was walking over to another little settlement around where we were through the jungle, and I heard a loud gunshot. You know, they had a shotgun. And when I got there, there was a dog dying. And a man was kneeled down by the dog, and he was crying. And I said, what happened? And he said, my brother shot my dog. And I said, why did he shoot your dog? And he said, he was drinking, and my dog was getting his dogs, was attacking his dogs. And he said, I love my dog. And I said, what are you going to do now? And he said, what do you mean? I said, are you going to do anything to your brother because he shot your dog? And he said, no, he shouldn't have shot my dog, but he's my brother. I wouldn't do anything to my brother. So this concept of vengeance and discipline physically, these sorts of things, their view, as I put it together, life is short. Why would you want to fill it with vengeance and hurting people? So there's this famous book about the Yanomami by Napoleon Chagnon, who at one time was the most famous anthropologist in the world. He's dead now. And his book is called The Fierce People, Yanomami, The Fierce People. It's been very controversial because of that title, because a lot of people don't like to think that there is a fierce people, you know. But if I were going to, you know, I often thought that I worked with the gentle people, not the fierce people. They're very different people. That could just be because I have a different view of life than Chagnon does, but I don't think so. There are a lot of murders among the Yanomami from his records. Others might dispute that, but the Pitahas just don't have violence in the day-to-day life of the tribe. There just isn't that. The main thing you hear at any time of the day is laughter. And I mean really loud laughter, not just chuckling laughter, but people screaming with laughter. Just so, you know, things are so funny. And I have a very similar sense of humor, you know. So we sit around and we laugh a lot. We talk about things. They're not formulaic jokes where they're, you know, you've got the structure to a joke. It's just sarcasm and seeing funny things and what happens in the world around us. And, you know, some of it's body humor. Some of it is, you know, like if I walk over to see everybody and I stumble and bump my head, well, they're going to break out laughing. They're going to find that extremely funny, you know. So, and they find it funny for two reasons. First of all, they want to show me that there's no reason to feel humiliated. This is just funny. So they don't want to humiliate people. Second, they just find it funny. So you're in this environment in which people don't take themselves too seriously.
I mean, it sounds so interesting what you're telling and so nice, but there were things that I read in your book that also shocked me a bit, to be honest. Like, you write about this woman that dies giving birth because her husband wasn't there to help and the others didn't help, or about the other incident where you tried to save a baby's life and then his or her own father killed it. What did you do in such moments, and did you want to like change their way of living together, because this was also heartbreaking for you?
Yeah, those were very difficult things, and they're not the only things. I mean, I didn't tell everything in the book, but when I was taking anthropology for the first time in 1972, this question came up. My anthropology teacher asked, what would you do if you saw, you know, them hurting somebody for a ritual, you know? Would you try to stop it? This is the problem of the anthropologist, to try to take genital mutilation. You know, if you're an anthropologist and you're seeing this happen, do you just study it or do you try to stop it? It's a constant issue for anthropologists, and that people make different decisions. But when it comes to this woman who died on the beach, the Pinaha have a very unusual view of survival and how much help you should need for survival. You know, it's possible that when they heard her screaming, they could already tell that there was nothing that could be done. I mean, I don't think that's true, but that could be their perspective. I mean, I think they might have thought nothing else can be done. I offered to go down. Not that I'm an experienced midwife. My wife offered to go down, and neither one of us had really delivered children, but we wanted to see if we could help, and they were told, absolutely not, we cannot go down there. Nobody else would go help her. As I say, you know, she was alone, and the next morning she was dead on the beach. And everybody lamented this fact, you know, she was such a nice person, and I'm so sorry that she died. But it wasn't like they thought they could do anything about it. I find that very strange, you know, but this is because I have grown up looking at things in one way, and they've grown up looking at things in another. There was a baby that was very sick. Its mother, who had been this beautiful young woman, got some disease that left her skin and bones, and she died. And her baby survived, also skin and bones. And the people felt there's no mother around to nurse the baby, so the baby's going to die. And I said, let us take care of the baby. And they said, okay, fine. So we would work, take turns, and we're up all night long working really hard on this baby. And we thought it was starting to make progress, taking milk that we mixed for it. None of the Pinaha women would give us breast milk because they needed it for their own children, but we made powdered milk, and we gave it sugar and things And one day we decided to go off for a walk, and we left the baby with its father. And when we got back, everybody was talking loudly, and I smelled alcohol very strongly in the air, and the baby was dead. And I realized they had forced alcohol down the baby's throat. And I said, the baby's dead. What happened to the baby? And the father said, it was suffering. It was in pain. It needed to die. It was dying anyway. It was not going to live. And I got really mad. I said, well, I think it was going to live. And they said, you were just hurting it. You know, you were just making it hurt longer. So that was really hard for me. But it showed me that, you know, my first experience with medical ethics, people have different views on life. And, for example, I might have medicine that could stop malaria, or medicine that could stop diarrhea, or medicine that could stop infections. But I can't force people to take it. They may just be afraid of them. We even see that in the world today, is people are afraid of the coronavirus vaccine. How can you make people put something in their body that they're afraid of? Maybe in the context of because it protects others, not just themselves. But among the Pinahas, I was not in a position to order anyone, and nor did I feel it was correct to order anyone to take medicine just because I thought it would be good for them. I might give you a malarial injection, and you have an allergic reaction that I wasn't anticipating, and you're dead. And I forced you to take it. Well, I'm responsible for your death. So that is not a responsibility that anybody else should take. People have to choose these things for themselves. There are a lot of hard lessons among the Pinaha, although by and large, they're gentle people. You know, just I wouldn't say that the people of Vienna are thieves, right? Nobody would say that Vienna is a city of thieves, but there are thieves in Vienna. You know, you will get robbed in Vienna. Some people get robbed every day, wherever you're at. You can't categorize people by individual incidents in their life or individual people who live against the values of the culture. So there are Pinaha who murder. There are Pinaha who rape. There are Pinaha who are cruel. But almost nobody is. You know, the ones that you find like that are so rare that you would never characterize the people as having those traits.
due to different reasons, as far as I know, you haven't been with the Peterhof for quite a while. Are you wishing and planning to go back and visit your friends?
Oh, I would very much like to go back to see the Peterhof. The main reason I can't go back is because of the controversy that was caused. A New York Times newspaper reporter called me about 10 years ago, and he said several Brazilian linguists have sent a letter to the Brazilian Indian Foundation saying that your research is racist because you say these people don't have recursion. Which, how on earth could that be racist? But it isn't. So this made, because I'm an American and they were Brazilians, how can we let this gringo come back who's saying racist things about our indigenous peoples? Of course, they never asked the Pitahá. The Pitahás would have want me to come back as much as possible. My ex-wife lives down there near them, and she sends me little videos of them, and they ask, when are you coming to see us? We haven't seen you. It's been so long. Come back and see us. Technically, I could go to places where it's not their reservation and see them, because I'm a permanent resident of Brazil, but this could cause problems. The ironic thing is they live on a reservation that I am the one who got given to them. I worked very hard and went down with the Indian agency and helped identify all the land that was theirs and give it to them. And now people, because I've described aspects of their grammar, so that's made it very difficult for me to go back. Right now, with Brazil's COVID situation, and they would not let me anywhere near the Pitahá, and that's right. So there's no way I can go back until COVID is sort of resolved. And I don't know. I would like to go back. But academics is a strange enterprise, which is, I tell academics they're very much like missionaries because they don't really make any serious money, right? Academics are not wealthy. They live a good life, but they're not wealthy. Their entire careers are built on egos. One person saying this guy's great and this guy's not so great. And so the dynamics of academics are very unlike the Pitahá. They're very unlike working in a factory. If you work in a Volkswagen factory, you're not necessarily trying to be recorded as the greatest person with a wrench in history. You're just doing your job, and then you go out and have a few beers with your friends, and you get home, watch a little TV, and do it again the next day. Academics take themselves very seriously. It's like they're the priests of knowledge, and they're doing really important stuff, although tomorrow nobody will agree with them. I mean, none of these ideas last. We're just doing the best we can. I tell people, I said, look, 200 years ago, we didn't even have toilet paper. We're not a really smart creature. We're just apes. And the idea that we're going to find the truth of the universe, we're just basically hairless gorillas. We set these absurd goals and take ourselves so seriously. We could learn a lot of lessons from the Pitahás as academics, for example, or intellectuals or politicians. I mean, politicians actually can affect people's lives, usually for the worse. Let's not take ourselves so seriously. That's not to say that I don't take my work seriously and want to do the very best job I can, but I realize it's just the best job that I can do. I'm not the smartest person that ever lived, and the smartest person who ever lived is really not all that smart compared to what you could imagine. We're a recently evolved species. Homo erectus lived over 2 million years, at least right around 2 million years. We haven't even lived 300,000 years yet. So we got a long ways to go as a species before we attain our potential. And even then, we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously.
When you say we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously, I also thought that we are afraid to really laugh loud. and they are not. Anyway, when you come to these things about being like the best you can be in our society, it's a lot about, you know, fulfilling all your potential and having concepts about who you should be. And as I understood, they don't even have a concept of beauty. And weirdly enough, the last weeks I thought about that most of the people I know or met wouldn't say that they're attractive or wouldn't find themselves beautiful. And I'm always struggling with why do we have beliefs that make us so unfree? Do you have an answer for that?
Well, one thing I do know, comparison with the Pitaha, is that relative personal beauty is a cultural concept. It's not a natural concept. I mean, it's not an instinct. People might want to think it's an instinct, but this doesn't exist among the Pitahas. They look at a person as a whole and they think, is this person lazy? Does this person help people? Is this person have good characteristics? Are they healthy? Now, those are positive values that have, you know, that are measurable. There are very attractive, by Western standards, Pitaha women and men. I mean, the average Pitaha man is not tall, but he is in great physical conditioning. He looks like he works at a gym all day, every day. He can run barefoot through the jungle for hours. He's symmetrical. You know, these are handsome people, but they don't think about it, you know, that much. They don't think that I'm more handsome or ugly. They probably think I'm uglier. If anything, the kids don't like me because I have a beard, and they say only dogs have hair on their face, you know, so dogs and other animals. But we are so preoccupied with not just being pretty or handsome, but being prettier or more handsome than other people. This is something, if you think about a relationship that you're in, one of the greatest signs to me of a healthy relationship is that you don't care always how you look. You know, you can. I have a friend who was also a missionary, a very funny guy. And when he was going to propose to his wife, he called her at 4 a.m. and woke her up. And he said, meet me for breakfast at this place, but do not brush your teeth, do not comb your hair, do not, just come in your nightgown and a robe. And you're, you know. So she came, they showed up at the restaurant. He was the same way. He said, could you look at this for every day for the rest of your life? And she said, I could. And he said, well, I find you beautiful just the way you are. So that's a sign of a very healthy relationship. I was never as creative as he was. That was a really cool thing to do. But as a society, we're not that way. We're not that relaxed with each other. But for the Pitaha, as a society, they're relaxed with each other. You know, I mean, there's also the fact that probably every Pitaha of the same age has had sex with every other Pitaha of the same age, because that's just something they do. And so everybody is like a family. I mean, you really are like in a constant relationship with every other member of the society. So everyone's at home with everyone else, and everybody knows everything about everybody else, and they accept everybody for who they are. And so that's a healthy environment. I mean, at least this knowledge of how people are and who they are. And lack of coercion, you know. What the Pitaha, the worst thing you can do is lose your temper. That's like, you can steal things from people, you can, you know, you can sleep with somebody else's spouse, but don't lose your temper. This is the worst thing you can do. So I talk in a loud voice very often because I've been a professor for so long. And when I start to talk to people, I often fall into my professor voice and start talking loud. And the Pitaha will run over and they'll say, are you angry? No, I'm just talking. Yeah, we're talking really loud. You sound angry. Don't talk loud like that. I mean, you can laugh loud. You can be as loud as you want. Just don't be an angry sort of loud. And that's a very good, I think, a very good and healthy reaction to anger. You would never hit anyone else. You know, somebody was in the village one time and a baby was crying and he said, what would they say if I went over there and slapped that baby? I said, oh, they wouldn't say anything, but they would kill you. He said, they would kill me. I said, yeah, what? You have no right to touch a little baby, especially not your baby, but their baby. He said, well, how would they kill me? I said, some night when you think everything's okay, an arrow is going to hit you right in the eye. He said, really? I said, they're not violent people, but you don't hurt them. You don't hurt their babies. These are not things that we think about very often in the West. There are different attitudes towards violence. Basically, violence is prohibited except in defense of your family. And then, you know, one guy said, are they dangerous? And I said, everybody's got a bow and arrow. That's how they make their living, is killing animals. I said, they're very dangerous if they want to be. I said, if he shoots at you, you know, like you see these movies where the indigenous people come out shooting arrows at the hero, and like Indiana Jones and this kind of stuff. You know, one Pinaha would shoot 30 arrows into him with no problem. He would not get away. These people are good with arrows. That's what they do. And so you just realize that. For me, it makes me comfortable. I never had a gun anytime I was in the village, even though I knew there were wild animals and all sorts of things. I let the Pinaha take care of me. So I never once had a gun.
You know, I take two advices from the part that you just told me now. First, don't lose your temper, because I'm really good in losing my temper, as I'm also a university teacher, so I also speak loud. And the second one is really surround yourselves with people that feel family to you and you really feel close to, because this makes a change. I have three last questions to you. The first one is, what is your biggest fear?
My biggest fear is not taking care of and being loved by those I love. Being responsible to do the things that I've said I will do, especially with regard to my family. I can't worry about them when I'm dead, that's not a fear. I don't fear what's going to happen to anybody I love after I die, because that's the end of me, and I did my bit. So my fear is not doing what I can do while I am alive.
What are you currently doing that you still don't know how it will turn out?
I'm writing a book on a subject that I've never investigated before in philosophy. When you publish a book, especially after you've published several books, your reputation is only based on your last book. And so if I get it wrong, I'll look like an idiot. So I don't want to get it wrong. And yet I want it to be very helpful, and I want it to be unusual. And that desire for it to be unusual is where the danger is.
The last thing is, I have this book here where I put in a lot of quotes that inspired me. So I will run through the pages and you will say stop at a certain moment. I will read you the quote and you just comment on it, whatever comes to your mind first. So I will start now and you say stop.
Stop.
Do you want to go left or right?
Left.
And where do you want to go? It's 2, 4, 6 quotes. So which one do you want to pick?
Let's go with quote 4.
Quote 4. You are the CEO of your life. Hire, fire, and promote accordingly.
That's a very good quote. We are indeed in charge of our own lives. We need to learn to edit our lives, cut out or fire those activities or people in our lives that are really not contributing to our sense of well-being, to our development, to our success with our family. So, yeah, not to blame other people for your problems and your bad decisions. It's easy to blame others, but ultimately we bear the blame if we're happy or sad, or we live a life of choices, and those choices eventually result in who we are at the end of our lives.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me back again.
If you like this podcast, please share and subscribe. If you're curious to hear more about hunters and gatherers, check out episode number 8, where I talk to Bettina Ludwig about communities without possession, comparison, or privacy. You find this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or on my website, inktotheunknown.at.